Do have that passage open in front of you, page 1242, Revelation chapter 13. Lots of numbers this evening. In the last 5 or 6 years, a new name has grown unpleasantly familiar. It's a name we associate with ruthlessness, suffering, and death. A name that we've come to dread hearing on the news because it generally means that some fresh atrocity has been carried out. The name is Al-Qaeda. Growing from its obscure origins in the camps of Afghanistan, it has gradually spread its influence to every part of the world. Since 1999, it's been responsible for bombings and attacks in East Africa, Arabia, Morocco, Indonesia, Central Asia, Turkey, New York, Madrid, and London, at least. It's used aircraft, it's bombed trains, ships, embassies, banks, nightclubs, offices. Its tentacles are everywhere. Around the world, governments and intelligence services are at their wits' end trying to get on top of it. An attack may be thwarted today, but they will try again tomorrow. Al-Qaeda is an organization that aims for nothing less than worldwide domination, where everyone will have one of two choices: to submit to it or to be destroyed by it. It's driven by an ideology that does not hesitate to kill on a grand scale and without any warning. And every time that it seems to be defeated in one place, it pops up in another. For every Al-Qaeda leader who is captured or killed, there is a new one waiting in the wings, all ready to record his message for broadcast on Al Jazeera television. It's a monstrous organization. It's deadly evil. It's horrible. Al-Qaeda is a deadly enemy. Now, what would the Bible have to say about a group like that? The Bible would say that Al-Qaeda is one small example of what Revelation 13 calls the beast, a monster who's in the service of Satan. And when we look at a gang like Al-Qaeda from the Bible's viewpoint, that's what we will see. That's what we're looking at tonight, the beast and his number. And what we're going to do is to unmask Satan's top agent for destroying the Church of Christ. Last week we started on a new section of Revelation, which covers chapters 12 to 14, a section which deals with the vast cosmic conflict that rages throughout human history. Again, it's a tale full of signs and symbols. Last time in chapter 12, we saw how Satan, pictured as a monstrous red dragon, was decisively defeated and thrown out of heaven. He was defeated fundamentally at the cross, where Jesus cried out in triumph, "It is finished," spelling the end of Satan's hopes. The ultimate battle is won. And yet Satan is not quite finished. He's not quite finished off. Here on earth, he has just a limited time remaining to cause mayhem for God's people, and that's exactly what he is doing. And chapter 12 finishes with Satan setting out in hot pursuit of the church. Yes, his cause is utterly lost, but he hasn't given up. Far from it. Chapter 12, verse 17, he is enraged, and he's out to get us. Everyone who obeys God's commands and holds to the testimony of Jesus. How long has he got? Well, last week and the week before and again today, we'll come across this symbolic time period labelled 42 months or 1,260 days. You can see it here in verse 5. And we've seen in each of these chapters that this time span stands for the whole church age. The time from Jesus' death and resurrection through to his second coming. 42 months for the church to witness, chapter 11. 42 months for God to protect his church while the dragon rages on earth, chapter 12. And now 42 months for the beast to be given authority over mankind. So it's clear by now that we're not just looking at a few brief events that will happen off at the end of time, although it certainly gets worse at the end. We're looking at what happens in our own time, right through until Jesus comes again. So, as we arrive at chapter 13, there is the dragon standing on the shore where the sea meets the land, intent on his schemes for striking at the church and doing as much damage as he possibly can before his time is up. And here's what he actually does. He summons not one beast, but two. One from the sea and one from the lands. Two beasts to serve him, to enslave the world and destroy the church. Two who will work closely together, partners, to accomplish the dragon's plans. Two beasts, the tyrant and the liar. The layout of the chapter is very simple. In each case, John introduces the beast, tells us what he does, and then tells us what we need to do about it. Let's look at the first beast, the tyrant. And I saw a beast coming out of the sea. He had 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 crowns on his horns, and on each head a blasphemous name. The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but had feet like those of a bear and a mouth like that of a lion. The dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and great authority. Well, it's not a very attractive description. What does it mean? Well, yet again, as we have seen throughout these studies, we're taken back to the Old Testament. Come with me to Daniel chapter 7. It'll be on the screen in a minute. One of a series of spectacular visions that the prophet Daniel was shown by God. Daniel 7, verses 2 to 7. Daniel said, "In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on 2 feet like a man, and the heart of a man was given to it. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its sides, and it had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. It was told, 'Get up and eat your fill of flesh.' After that I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard. And on its back it had 4 wings like those of a bird. This beast had 4 heads, and it was given authority to rule. After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a 4th beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. It's not hard to work out that the beast in Revelation 13 is a sort of hideous composite of the 4 beasts that Daniel saw. One looks like a lion, one like a bear, one like a leopard, and there are all the body parts stuck together, incorporated in Revelation. And the 4th, the most terrifying of the lot, has 10 horns. And all 4 beasts emerge from the sea. Remember, for the Israelites, the sea wasn't somewhere you went for your holidays and built sandcastles or went for a nice cruise. The sea was a symbol of chaos. They feared it. They didn't go near it if they could help it. If we look a little further on in Daniel 7, we get even more of the background. Verse 17 explains what the 4 beasts are. The 4 great beasts are 4 kingdoms that will rise from the earth. Verse 24 explains that the 10 horns represent 10 kings. And in Daniel, to make matters even more complicated, there is an extra horn which appears. And in verse 25, the extra horn does this. He will speak against the Most High and oppress his saints and try to change the set times and the laws. The saints will be handed over to him for a time, times, and half a time. 3.5 years, that is, or 42 months. And 650 years after that vision, John is given a vision of a hideous beast, which combines all the most unpleasant features of Daniel's beasts, reigns for 42 months, blasphemes the Most High God, and attacks the saints. Now, Daniel's beasts represent four specific kingdoms or empires, and all the obscure references to three ribs and four wings and four heads all actually have a historical referent in the kingdoms that follow Daniel's vision. But Revelation puts them all together into one, and its identity is clear: the beastly power of earthly empires. Oh yes, and like the dragon, the beast of Revelation has seven heads, just to remind us who its master really is, because it also looks like the dragon. This is tyranny in the service of Satan. Now, just hang on there. Doesn't Paul say somewhere that government is a gift of God, and that Christians should obey their rulers and recognize that they're God's servants with an important job to do? Yes, he does, in Romans 13. And sometimes people put up Romans 13 and Revelation 13 as a contradiction. How can the Roman Empire, for instance, be both good, God's gift, and a hideous, ravening beast on the other? Which are we to believe? Paul in Romans or John in Revelation? And the answer is that government is a gift of God's. No Christian should ever be an anarchist. We recognize the Bible's testimony that all men are fallen, sinful, and therefore we need governments to restrain evil and keep order. We should be grateful for good, peaceful government. We really should. If you want to know what happens when government is taken away, look at a place like Somalia, or, for that matter, New Orleans a month ago, and ask if you'd rather be living here or there. But just like many of God's other good gifts, government can be seized by Satan and used for evil. And that's what we're looking at here. The beast doesn't stand for all governments. He stands for tyranny, government perverted into an instrument of Satan. Tyranny that he uses to enslave the whole world. See what it looks like. Verse 3. It seems to have had a fatal wound, but it's been healed. The beast seems invincible. Like Al-Qaeda, you could knock it down in one place, but it just pops up in another. Every time a Berlin Wall comes down in one capital, an Ayatollah or a Mugabe takes power in another. You think the beast is done for? But somehow he never is. Tyranny marches on. Or verse 4, men worship the dragon and they worship the beast. Who is like the beast and who can fight him? The beast is popular, you see. That might surprise us. But if you look at any great tyrant, you will see that the great mass of the population are perfectly willing to follow them, either gladly or in fear. History shows that's true. Hitler, Mussolini, Franco, for long periods they were almost literally worshipped by millions. They were national saviours. They were strong leaders and their people were proud of them. And in that case, it's not surprising, verses 5 and 6, that the tyrant takes the place of God's. The tyrant sets himself up as an alternative God, a replacement God. This beast even has blasphemies inscribed on his heads. Now, frequently, dictators create their own personal mythology or have others do it for them. Stories are written that appear to imply godlike qualities for the tyrant. Most of all, they demand people's unquestioning and unconditional submission, something that only God himself has the right to do. It's blasphemy, which leads neatly on to Satan's key objective. Look at verses 7 and 8. he, the beast, was given power to make war against the saints and to conquer them. And he was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation. All inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast, all whose names have not been written in the book of life belonging to the Lamb that was slain from the creation of the world. This is what it's really all about. The beast is Satan's tool to attack the saints, to make war against the church of Jesus. And down through the years, it has been the greatest tyrants who have unleashed the fiercest persecution. After all, the whole point of being a tyrant is that everyone should serve you, not some god. So whether it was Roman emperors, or the Habsburgs during the Reformation years, or Louis XIV, or Stalin, or Idi Amin, wherever there has been a faithful church which refuses to worship the beast, the beast makes war on them. We know that God is building his church from every language and nation. We celebrate that every Sunday as we meet together, don't we? But here we see again that Satan is building a people as well, an anti-church from every language and nation. And everyone who does not belong to Jesus, who does not have his name written down in the Lamb's Book of Life, is with Satan in the anti-church. And the beast is there to help him gather recruits and to crush the opposition. You see how the beast's followers are described here? The inhabitants of the earth. We've noticed that expression before more than once. It comes four times in this chapter alone. The people who are at home here on earth, who know no other world, unlike the people who belong to the Lamb. You and I know we are not inhabitants of the earth. But the people around us are. Next week we'll look at the final outcome of this great divide, and it's an awesome passage, which in many ways I'm dreading preaching on, because it comes to such an awful conclusion at the end of chapter 14. But the solemn truth is that you are either with the Lord Jesus or you are with the beast. He who has an ear, says John, let him hear. This message is for Christians. It's a warning of what we can expect at any time. John's first readers were in the middle of it. We're not yet. But there is suffering ahead. So what's the answer? How do we guard ourselves against such times coming to us? Make sure you live in a democracy? Is that it? Is that protection against the beast? Hardly. We should never forget that it was a democratic election that brought Hitler to power. He got a far higher proportion of the vote, you know, than Tony Blair has ever done. It was democracy that brought Robert Mugabe to power. We don't put our faith in democracy any more than in any other human system. Our own democracy is beginning to turn the screws on us. In any case, some of the best governments in history have been far from what we call democratic. No, for us as believers, the answer is quite different. Verse 10. If anyone is to go into captivity he will go. If anyone is to be killed with the sword he will be killed. This calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of the saints. This verse warns us that suffering will come. That's the message. And we're not told to look for it, but we're not told to run away from it either. When we find ourselves under the beast, believers are told simply to endure and stay faithful. Keep the faith. It hasn't always happened. Hitler didn't have to persecute the church in Germany very much. Most of them were compromised and simply rolled over. Only a few, like Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Martin Niemöller, showed this patient endurance and faithfulness. They were faithful to Jesus, and the beast killed them. There are times, you see, when the one place where a believer can be faithful to the Lord will be the execution cell. Beast 1, the tyrant. Now let's turn to the second beast, the liar. The liar. You might well ask, however does the first beast achieve his results so easily? Here's the answer. Then I saw another beast coming out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. He exercised all the authority of the first beast on his behalf and made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose fatal wounds had been healed. The dragon, as it were, faces the sea to summon the first beast from there and now turns to call forth the second beast from the earth, probably representing his direct opposition to heaven. If we have any doubts about the second beast's identity, we have only to glance ahead to chapter 19, verse 20, where he's named as the false prophet. He it is who serves the first beast and enables him to do his dirty work. Every tyrant, you see, needs a lie to keep him in power. And the bigger the lie, the better it works. You need a big lie to dominate millions of people. So how does the second beast do it? Well, there are at least four methods picked out here. And if you know anything about recent history, you'll see how brilliantly these pick out the characteristics of modern-day dictatorships. He puts on a great show, verses 13 and 14. See him doing all kinds of dramatic and spectacular signs to induce people to worship the first beast. And he deceives them into doing it. He goes on to create a personality cult, making people set up an image of the first beast. You see, by the way, how the dragon, Satan himself, stays cleverly well in the background all through this process. People are mostly not so stupid nor so depraved as to worship Satan directly and knowingly. But they love his servants. And that's part of the lie. Then the second beast enforces a reign of terror. Verse 15, he was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast so that it could speak and cause all who refused to worship the image to be killed. All these methods fit together so neatly. Follow the lie, join the personality cult, or else. But people might still escape. So there is one final method, economic control. Everyone is made to wear a mark to prove that they belong to the beast. That is the first beast. And if they don't, they will starve. No one could buy or sell unless he had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of his name. The beast's methods. So what is the second beast? He is simply every ideology that has ever been set up to support godless tyranny. He is the communism of the Soviet Union, with its spectacular parades through Red Square, its cult of Lenin and Stalin, its party card for the privileged. That was one lie. He is Nazism, with its Nuremberg rallies and its Hitler Youth. Nazism, which marked its supporters with the swastika and its victims with coloured stars. That was another lie. The state-led tribalism of Rwanda, which swept people up into genocide and forced them to take part until close on a million lay dead in the fields. The statues of Saddam, which infested Iraq. The wall posters of Chairman Mao. All signs of the second beast at work. All these features are there. The liar. But the second beast is not just those great ideologies of the 20th century. Even more than that, and working still more closely hand in hand with the first beast, is the liar of false religion. That's where the miracles and signs, verse 13, really come in. The second beast is the false prophet, the great deceiver. Most people are deceived, even some believers, because sometimes the second beast can even disguise himself as a church. And this is something Jesus warned us about as well in that famous passage in Matthew 24. He said this, "At that time, if anyone says to you, 'Look, here is the Christ,' or 'There he is,' do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and miracles to deceive even the elect, if that were possible. See, I have told you ahead of time. Don't be deceived by the false Christs. Don't be terrified by the false religion. When the Roman emperors began to think of themselves as gods, that's when trouble came for the church. Revelation was written during the reign of Domitian, whose chosen title for himself was Dominus et Deus, Lord and God. No wonder he exiled people like John. And today, most of the toughest places for the church are where false religions hold their sway. Worst of all, where those religions walk hand in hand with governments, the two beasts grinning at one another as they persecute the Church of Christ. The false prophet supplies the backing for the tyrant to continue his work. To be an Arab, they say, is to be a Muslim. To be a true Indian, you must be a Hindu. If you're a Christian, you're obviously a traitor. You're not worshipping properly. You're not wearing the right mark. Let's have a look at your identity card. And yes, there are even places today where you cannot buy or sell unless you belong to the beast. On the day I was preparing this message, there were examples in two prayer diaries that I'm using at the moment. Some of you will have seen these, will remember them. One was from a village in India where a crowd of Hindu extremists had attacked a church and later called for a boycott against the Christians to prevent them from using the village well or buying food in the markets. The other case was from West Africa, where a young man named Boubacar had converted to Christ from Islam, could not find work in his home village because of his Christian faith. He didn't have the right mark, you see. It's not very politically correct today to describe anything as a false religion, but it's true, even so. Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, many others are false religions offering false Christs and deceiving the inhabitants of the earth. People who are following these religions are following the beast. They're believing the great liar. Islam is a great lie. Perhaps the biggest lie in the world today. Hang on, you may say, aren't you one of the guys who's always going on about loving Muslims and reaching out to them? Yes, of course. Because the real victims of Islam are the Muslims. The ones who are caught in its trap. And when I see them, as I do every day of the week in this building, my heart goes out to them. Because they are caught in a lie, a great lie. And our job is to help them escape, to be free. So, what's our response to the liar? At first sight, John seems to be suggesting that we should solve a mathematical puzzle, a sort of cosmic Sudoku. Verse 18, this calls for wisdom. If anyone has insight, let him calculate the number of the beast, for it is man's number. His number is 666, one of the best known verses of the whole book. Now, what are we to do with this mysterious number? Often people start from the fact that in many ancient languages, letters were used to stand for numbers. Hebrew, for instance, didn't have separate numerals. They used the letters of the alphabet instead. So in a language like that, every letter of the alphabet stands for some number. And so you can take any name, like Steve, and turn it into numbers. And then if you add the numbers together, you have a total which stands for that person. So some people say that 666 was a code for the Emperor Nero. And that's been a popular view. But that only works if you call him Nero Caesar. Take the Greek spelling, transliterate it into Hebrew, and then spell it wrong. And none of John's readers would have understood Hebrew anyway. But then you can get 666. And by the way, no one actually came up with this suggestion until the 19th century. So they were a bit late. Other people have worked out schemes to make 666 fit a whole host of other candidates, including Domitian, the emperor in John's own day, Muhammad, Cromwell, Martin Luther, and Napoleon. More recently still, people have found the number 666 in computer-readable barcodes, the sort that they scan at supermarket checkouts. If you want to know how that one works, I'll tell you afterwards. Or else it's got something to do with credit cards. But all of this is barking up the wrong tree. It all springs from the misguided idea that Revelation is a kind of cosmic puzzle book, where if you've got the right skills or the right teacher, you can crack the codes and solve the puzzle. A truth, I believe, is actually a lot simpler than that. 666, think about it. What is the number of perfection? The number of completeness in this book? The number we have seen over and over again. It's 7. And 6 is 1 short of 7. What would be the ideal symbolic number for someone who repeatedly attempts to imitate that perfection, who pretends to be all that God is and yet ultimately fails, time after time after time? 666. The number of the beast. The number of fallen man. The number of empty failure. If I can put it like this, it's the Bible's way of sticking up 2 fingers at the beast, or blowing an almighty raspberry at him. See, the text doesn't say this calls for a maths degree. It says this calls for wisdom. The word used here for insight is actually nous, spiritual nous. That's what the Bible means by wisdom. Nothing to do with intelligence or education. So this is the message. If you have a spiritual mind and understanding, you will be able to recognize the beast for what he really is. A counterfeit. A falsehood. Don't be deceived. Don't be taken in. So, we've looked at what the two beasts do for their master, Satan. You may be thinking, that hasn't got much to do with me. You may say, oh, sounds terrible. Tyranny, the grip of false religions? Huh, thank goodness it's not like that here. Let's go home, think about something else. But I tell you, this is entirely normal. As we were reminded at the Christian Institute meeting here on Tuesday night, not only are many Christian believers persecuted today, but that's how it normally is. It's what we should expect. We can be very grateful for the freedoms we have, but we shouldn't be too shocked when they are closed down. Our spiritual ancestors, centuries ago, fought long and hard against the beast, and for the last few hundred years it's been kept more or less quiet, as far as this country is concerned. But what our ancestors fought for is now being pulled down, and the beast is on his way back again. So our freedom may first of all be cut down by the very polite false prophet of political correctness. The false prophet who preaches that the only truth is that there is no final truth. That's how it will probably start. So what do? Well, we recognize the beast. We've got his number. And we know what he is. We know what he is up to. And that means we will support our brothers and sisters who are under the cosh, where they're under far greater pressure than we are. That's why we frequently pray here for the persecuted church. Why we support groups like the Barnabas Fund, who boldly speak the truth about false religions and reach out to care for the persecuted. And recognizing the beast also means watching out for what he's up to here. The religious hatred bill, whether it is passed or not, is a faint little indication of what's to come. Do Do you understand what is going on here? Have you got the insight to calculate the number of the beast? What do? We declare against the beast that Jesus is Lord. The great cry of the early church when they were called on to say, Caesar is Lord, and escape death. No, he's not. Jesus is Lord. Not just my Lord. He's not just Lord in here, inside my head. He's not just Lord of my private life. He is that, but far more than that. He is Lord, an absolute statement. That's a much bigger claim. And it is true. He is Lord out there. He is the true Lord of the whole world. The beast can't stand that. Satan knows it's true, but he can't bear the thought of it. What do? We endure patiently and faithfully. The beast has limited time. We've got forever. The beast's days are numbered, not ours. And while the beast is still here, while the dragon still thrashes around, we are called to stand firm and pay the cost and remain true to the name of our Saviour. What do? Lastly, we remember our names are in the book of life. We are not the inhabitants of the earth, content to be led astray by the false prophet and worship the beast. Brothers and sisters, there is a list in heaven. There is a list, and if we have confessed Jesus as Lord, then our names are on that list in permanent ink that no power can remove.